The world's population continues to grow. By some estimates, we'll add another 2 billion people by the year 2050.
A new series in National Geographic magazine explores the question of how to feed all those people while preserving the natural environment.
Our next guest kicked off the series with the cover story of the May issue. It's called Food, Feeding 9 Billion. Jonathan Foley is with us now. He's director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, first, let's talk about the growing demand for food, driven obviously in part by population increase. Is there more to that story, though?
Oh, absolutely. As you mentioned, there are basically 7 billion people in the world today, but if populations grow the way we expect in the few decades, we'll be at 9 billion. That would be about a 28% increase in the number of people in the world. And most of those people will be added to very poor countries of the world. So that's a real problem. But simultaneously, we have about 3 to 4 billion people in the world already here who are suddenly getting a lot richer than their ancestors were. Think China, India, Russia, Brazil, other places. And they're forming a new kind of global middle class that's eating richer foods, just like Americans and Europeans do. And so as we add more prosperous people to the world right now and more people altogether in the future, we're having a tremendous increase in the amount of food we require, maybe as much as needing a doubling of global food supplies by 2050 if we don't curb our diets and our population.
How much does this put our environment, our natural resources, at risk?
Well, agriculture is such a big force on this planet. It already uses about 40% of all the land there is on the planet is used to grow food, more than anything else by a large margin. It also uses about 70% of all the water we consume. And also, agriculture is one of the biggest contributors to climate change through things like tropical deforestation, methane from cattle and rice fields, and overusing fertilizers, which can form something called nitrous oxide. So even today's agriculture is a huge impact on the environment if we don't do it better. And if we have to double it by the middle of the century, we could have a real crisis on our hands unless we get smarter.
You know, if you want to start an argument these days, talking about our food and how it's produced is a pretty good way to start. Are we getting polarized when it comes to agriculture?
Yeah, I think unfortunately we are. Well, you know, naturally people are pretty passionate about food. It's part of our culture and our heritage and who we are, and, you know, that's all very appropriate. But I think kind of like climate change and other things, we've gotten beyond cultural polarization. We've kind of gotten political and economic polarization. We just like to fight over these things for some bizarre reason. I don't think that's very constructive because nobody has all the answers. I think we all have some of the answers, and I'd like to see people collaborate more across these divides because no one small group can decide the future of us all. We're all going to have to figure out how to work together and do these things collaboratively, and that would be really much more helpful.
You offer at least some solutions in the article we mentioned earlier. You've got a 5-step plan. I wanted to get a taste of what you're looking to see change. The first step, freezing the agricultural footprint, you say, is a priority. What is that? What do we need to do?
Well, one of the biggest things we do in agriculture that hurts the environment is, especially in the tropics, we're clearing rainforests to grow more crops. And that's really harmful to the environment and often doesn't really benefit people for food security, that is, feeding the world's poor. What we need to do is stop clearing forests and grow, if we need more food, grow it on the land we've already got. And so the first two recommendations are, you know, stop deforestation, and second, grow the food we need on the land we already have and just learn how to grow it better on land we've cleared before.
Well, that involves more intensive agriculture. And speaking of those arguments, some people are worried about what it takes in terms of fertilizer, pesticide, overuse of soil to grow more food on the land we've got. How do we get around those issues?
Well, that leads to the third recommendation, is we could be far more efficient at delivering more nutrition. Not, you know, and yields aren't the only thing. It isn't just how much stuff we grow. It's also how much nutrition there is and how many people really get fed with it. So that's another question. But we could also be far more efficient by borrowing techniques from, let's say, the organic movement and the kind of agroecology, as sometimes we call it, but also learning how to use high-tech approaches like precision agriculture using GPS and automated kind of sensors that let us, if we do use any chemicals, use them very precisely insofar as we only need this much in this place right now. So borrowing kind of from the organic and the conventional, we could see very big improvements in the kind of use of chemicals, water, and energy could be vastly much less than they are today. And so we could get more food with less harm to the environment if we work together.
We could do these things. Are we to any great extent?
In fact, yes. I think there are some very helpful signs. For example, deforestation in Brazil, a place that used to have massive amounts of deforestation, has dropped by about 70% in the last several years, mainly through collaboration between environmental groups and agriculture and government. It's been extraordinary. In the U.S., we've seen improvements in kind of how much food we grow for every unit of fertilizer among the conventional farmers as they're getting more precise, but also the organic farmers are getting more numerous. The organic part of the industry is getting really big, really fast, and that's, you know, kind of good signs in both areas. There are still troubling parts of the world where things are definitely not going the right way, but I guess the good news, bad news here is we kind of have to solve this problem. We don't have a choice. And so eventually we'll kind of get off our high horses and try to figure out how to do this and stop fighting and get collaborating and find ways to solve the problem.
Before we get to your last couple of recommendations, when an individual, a citizen, a voter is thinking about important issues, this might be off their radar, or if it's on their radar, it might be, seem too big and overwhelming to try to be part of a solution. Are we, as people, are policymakers starting to take this more seriously?
Well, yeah, I think at both levels. I think as individuals, we take these, you know, the food movements we see in America. People are more and more conscious of what we eat and how it affects our health and the environment around us. And that's a good thing, I think. More awareness is always a good thing if it's truly informative. But also policymakers, whether they're in government or in industry or NGOs or environmental groups, all of these different sectors are seeing food as kind of an important nexus of how we'll have to think about the future. Whether it's our economy, our environment, our security, food is pretty important. If we don't have it, we're really in trouble. So after 2008, especially when big food price spikes and even food riots were happening around the world after that, I think policymakers all over the world are getting much more concerned about our food system and how we can make it better.
Taking it to the cultural and personal level, you say another important step, changing our diets.
Yes, absolutely. The last two recommendations are first changing diets and maybe biofuels as well. And that's because, you know, what we grow isn't always what we eat. In Wisconsin, I spent about 20 years in Wisconsin. Love the state, know it well. We grow a lot of things like corn and soybeans in Wisconsin and Minnesota, where I live now, and places like Iowa. But those aren't people food. We don't eat the soybeans or the feed corn. They're fed to animals. And that's fine if you like meat and dairy products, of course. But that's not 100% efficient. You can't grow 100 calories of corn and expect to get 100 calories of beef out of that. In fact, you get about 3 of new beef production, boneless beef, that is, with 100 calories of feed added to the animal. It's pretty inefficient sometimes. Same thing, it's a little bit better for pork and chicken, but dairy is perhaps the most efficient of all. But what we see is that eating lots of animal products uses more resources, no matter what. And so we have to think wisely about how to use those resources. Now, I'm not saying everybody should become a vegetarian or anything like that overnight, but I do think we have to be more mindful of our meat and dairy production and consumption in America and think about how we can maybe do better. And that's true also around the world. And increasingly in the U.S., we also have to think about biofuels. An awful lot of the corn we grow is used for ethanol production and for animal feed. And so, you know, is that a choice we want to make? So far, the answer seems to be yes, but not everybody agrees about that. Maybe we should have a bigger discussion.
And your last recommendation, reduce food waste.
Yeah, and that's the one that, well, thankfully isn't so controversial, is food waste. Everybody seems to agree with this one, but we do so little about it. About 30 to 50% of all the food grown in the world is never eaten. In rich countries, we often, you know, throw it away in our refrigerators, our cafeterias, our dorms, whatever. But it's also true in poor countries because farmers may not be able to get their harvest to market because it spoils or it never got to the right road or the right train or whatever. So we have a lot of opportunities to increase the amount of food in the world without using a single drop more water or chemicals or land or whatever, just by being more efficient with what we've already grown. It's kind of like in Wisconsin, you know, if your house is cold, you could try to buy a bigger furnace or you could insulate your attic. Why don't we use both sides, the supply side and the demand side, to balance ourselves out and get enough food for all without compromising the environment?
So with the diet issue, you mentioned a big growing middle class around the world wanting that richer diet, two billion more people coming online in the world. are we really going to be able to do these little steps on a big enough scale to fix this problem?
I think we, well, I think we can. It's not a guarantee by any means. It's going to be an awful lot of hard work. It's going to be controversial. There are people who are not going to like some of these changes and so on. And it will have, you know, to take place over a period of time. So we have that for us, at least, and we have time to do this. But it does require some pretty big changes. Again, we who are already here, who are already wealthy, we have to change our ways probably first before we could be telling people who are beginning to be wealthier or people yet to be born what they should be eating and how they should farm. But the good news is there are lots of opportunities using different types of farming techniques, looking at our diets, thinking about biofuels, thinking about food waste. There's no one silver bullet here, but there's a heck of a lot of silver buckshot laying around that we could use.
Jonathan, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you so much.
That was Jonathan Foley, author of National Geographic Magazine's May cover story on Feeding 9 Billion. That's kicking off an 8-month series on food. You can find more info at natgeofood.com.